right, we're taping, and I'll start the music. Hello, and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. I am Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores.
Oh, this is where we're simplifying the good life.
Oh, we screwed it up again. We're broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
Do you think, should I change that from broadcasting to podcasting? Are we actually, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd have to like really dissect the nuances. I
have to think about that, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
it's not like we're going over the radio.
Exactly. We're the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communication, and the internet.
And holy shit, look over there, it's Dr. Jeff.
And hey, Dr. Jeff.
We just finished taping the episode that will drop for you, the listener, next week. This is episode 120. Featuring our interview with Miki Blizzard, former, just very recently retired, assistant to Earl Blumenauer, I believe, who is the bikey representative from Portland, and Michael Anderson is also here in the room with us. Hello, Michael, again.
Hi.
But it's like it's the first time, because this is coming out first.
Yeah, this is like time travel in a way.
Yeah, I think we posited that Earl Blumenauer has pasta that's shaped like bow ties and bicycles, something like that, and that's what he eats for lunch, so... That's like my favorite joke from that crossover episode we did with you, Michael, and with Lily. So it stuck with me. I think I've referenced it like 5 times now since then.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's that was fruitful conversation. Well, hey, this is what do we talk about now? Because we've already talked about everything.
I could talk about getting right hooked again, and the listeners will hear it again next week.
That's true, and about how drunk I was last night and how I almost feel better. I feel great now.
Right. Oh, this just occurs to me. Like, you're talking about how drunk you were last night, but that won't air until next week. So everyone's going to think you were drunk week from today.
So I kind of have license to drink again next weekend.
That's right. Okay. No, I think it's your duty to drink.
Otherwise, it alters the space-time continuum.
Exactly. Or you have a week-long hangover.
That's it. Okay. Well, I mean, we got a ton of stuff to talk about. We should probably just dive right into our headlines.
Sure.
And then I think we have some mail to address as well. So let me just go right to that now. This is your headlines music.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. It circles around the city lights.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight. Pedal just as fast as we can into the night light. Pedal just as fast as the leg, the letter. Your pedal just as fast.
All right, our first one is awesome. From the Seattle Bike Blog, Washington politician Ed Orcutt claims bicyclists exhale pollution.
And to start off with, Dr. Jeff and Michael, yeah, I'm sure you have both heard this story by now 100 times. And yeah, I can't remember which listener it was that sent this to me. He had like a news app that he was sending me things with, and I'll find his name here in a moment. Aaron, what do we have on this story?
All right. The state representative made some controversial statements here. You would be giving off more CO2 if you are riding a bike than driving in a car, he said. However, he said he had not done any analysis of the difference in CO2 from a person on a bike compared to the engine of a car. You can't say there's no pollution as a result of riding a bicycle.
Yeah.
He also stands by his opinion that people who bike do not pay for roads when they ride. When you're riding your bicycle, tell me what taxes are being generated by the act of riding your bicycle, he says. Sales tax does not go into roads. The Seattle Bike Blog responds that people who bike don't pay for roads is demonstrably untrue. Most roads people bike on are paid for by counties and municipalities. In Seattle, gas taxes pay just 4% of the SDOT budget as of 2009. Most of the rest comes from sources everybody pays, no matter how they get around. On a state level, gas taxes only pay for one quarter of the Washington DOT budget.
Yeah. And he did realize that his statements were absurd. I don't know that he expected it to blow up as much as it did, because this was kind of private correspondence, as I understand. I mean, in as much as a publicly elected representative corresponding can be private. But yeah, I think he was in talks with someone from a cycling club up in Pierce County, King County. Yeah. And so anyways, it was, yeah.
And help me out here. This is in... partially in reference to a proposed bicycle tax.
Yeah, this has been, I think Jonathan Moss on bikeportland.org, I think he probably gave some coverage to this issue. It was the idea that, as I remember, it was called a largely symbolic tax, basically to placate people who are really excited about driving cars, that they could look at this tax and say, look, we're taxing bicyclists as well. So if you buy a bike of what, like over $500 value or something like that, they would tack on an extra however much tax just to say, look, we're you bicyclists are helping to pay for the roads too.
Right.
So yeah, it's a really interesting thing. There's a lot of stuff to talk about on this just because it's there's a couple different issues. I think the people like who pays for the roads, basically, that's an argument that's been around for a long time, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. Michael, do you have any insight on that that controversy?
It is actually different roads, in Oregon. Basically in Oregon, in Portland, auto drivers do pay for most of the road. So most of our public transportation does flow from automobiles. Of course, most people who have bikes and get around on bikes also get around on cars. So it's not like it's like a freeloading. And the thing is that bikes don't damage the roads and they don't use much space. So they're very, very efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of the arguments that are made against welfare that basically come from really...
people who haven't had any experience on welfare?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's like people who say, like, those people should just nut up and get jobs. And it's right. Like, really, that it's a complicated system, you know, and situation. And it becomes a whipping boy. It's kind of like the set up a straw man and knock him down, basically.
So. I like the irony in someone who spews pure bullshit talking about emissions. I think that's kind of cool.
There is that as well. Yeah, and I mean, I can say just from having been drunk last night and working off a hangover this morning, I'm very glad that I had emissions to help vaporize some of the alcohol out of my system this morning. That helped a great deal, I believe. So, yeah. It's a fascinating topic, fascinating story. I think the rhetoric going around about this, I feel like the letter probably was. I don't know if he was actually claiming that bicycles are pollutants. I don't think he actually believes that. I would like to believe that someone who's elected as an official would be smarter than to try and make that intellectual argument.
But you know, there's a larger issue here, which is just polarization of politics and of public discourse, and the fact that it has to be like cars versus bikes. Mm-hmm. Rather than, hey, we're all, you know, the same people and let's talk about how we can just make this thing work.
Right.
And so it's like, I'm going to stake out this position and then this will get this. And it's just a larger picture there too.
Orchid's from Kalama, which is a city that I used to cover as a journalist for the Longview newspaper. And this is a common thread that you hear from politicians in both parties in the Longview area, because there are lots of industrial polluters in the Longview area, and they have an economy that's largely based around being able to have emissions, and people have an incentive to spew bullshit, like the fact that breathing carbon dioxide when you're also like part of an ecosystem is the same thing as like digging fossil fuels out of the earth from billions of years ago and then spewing them into the atmosphere.
Yeah. We all know how sustainable an emissions-based economy is, right?
Right, right. The funny thing is I actually had on a water bottle, I think I had an Ed Orchid sticker that I got at the Clark County Fair back in like 2002 or something. Yeah. And so I, you know, I wasn't political. I didn't know him from Adam or whoever. And I just I grabbed the sticker. I'm like, hey, it's free. I'll put it on my water bottle.
Much more valuable than it was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. No kidding. I have no idea what happened to that. It's probably long gone by now. But anyway, so that was exciting. That happened. I do think also there's the idea of the way we talk about things, and Moss from Bike Portland has addressed this many times about the language that we use and the way that we discuss things. It tends to be polarizing, because when we're talking about modes of transit, we talk like, well, bikes do this and cars do this. And there's a person behind the wheel or behind the handlebars of each one of those. And the more we address people as humans and talk about, you know, like These are just people trying to relate to each other in the world out there. Like it or not, we all live here. As opposed to trying to, like you were saying, Jeff, polarization. I think the language that we use does kind of affect that discourse. So
absolutely. Yeah.
We'll see how that, you know, how that changes as time goes by. We shall see. So let me get you one of these things for a new story.
Highlights from the National Women's Bicycling Forum. Jonathan Miles from Bike Portland writes, 325 advocates, well over 90% of which were women, enjoyed an entire day of panel discussions, workshops, networking, top-notch speakers, and more. The League of American Bicyclists has created a platform, and women have stepped up in a big way. The diversity and lack of men in the crowd stood in stark contrast to any league event I'd ever been to. There was also palpable sense of excitement and support. Everywhere I turned, women were engaged in lively discussions and were making connections with other advocates. Some things we can count on is that these amazing women will make bicycling in America more stylish, supportive, family-oriented, and joyful.
Yeah, it was a big event, and
that's awesome.
Yeah. Both of our previous guests from just a couple shows ago, Martina and Ellie, were both there, and were participating and doing things. So it's cool that was happening. I'm glad that gender is not just being addressed, but like I feel like this is kind of a symbol of women taking hold of something that is rightly theirs as much as it is men's. And yeah, and I feel like any time in this world that you can shift that gender balance a little bit, I feel like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, if only because a lot of us were assholes back in the day when when we decided how this culture was going to work and all that. So, yeah.
I was there too.
Were you?
Yeah. When the founding fathers.
Oh, I thought you meant at the women's forum.
No.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, they wouldn't. They didn't want me there.
It's like the up on Highway 30. There's the Women's Forum, which I've never quite understood what that meant. I assume at some point there was like a historic group of women that stood there and looked at the scenery or something. But
I stop there every time.
That's beautiful. Beautiful view.
And I never read the plaque.
Okay, yeah. So I gotta check that. There's a plaque there.
Yeah,
it probably tells us why.
It tells you why it's called the Women's Forum.
Okay, that
I think there's
sense.
An institutionalized sexism comment to make here, but I'm just gonna let it go.
Well, that's reverse sexism, so it's okay.
Right.
Let's close out our headlines. That's what we had from that. Anything, Michael, from you on the no? You're glad it happened. Yeah. It's closing headlines. There we go.
You're taking a lot of responsibility in owning and riding a bicycle. You are now an operator of a wheeled vehicle.
And now we have some mail, so we should probably address this. Got a letter from Steve in Wyoming, and he made some statements about women in the cycling industry following our interview with Martina and Ellie. So you want to read what's there?
Yeah. Not sure what he means by this first statement here. Women don't show up. 30 years ago, when I was a partner in a bike shop, there were quite a few women sales reps. Today, there are almost none. Oh, he's saying that as a declarative, not a request.
Mm-hmm.
Women don't show up. Okay.
No. I don't think he's, We don't want to paint him the wrong
way. I was really
here.
Confused there.
There's no comma in there. You're all right.
Okay. As women have moved into the professions, they have bypassed the cycling industry. Cycling industry has always been open to the willing, man or women, but women just aren't showing up. Whoa. We fielded a response from Ellie on this note, and she mentions that if I learned nothing else this week at the Women's Bike Summit, it's that if you want people to come to your party, it helps to actually invite them first and make them feel welcome when they do show up. Steve also notes that the only part of the cycling industry where I see more women now are in shops. There are more women bike mechanics now than there were 30 years ago, and there are more women salespeople.
Yeah, I want to say we probably disagree with you, Steve. We appreciate the commentary, but I feel like if there is a lack of women in the cycling industry, it's not because they don't want to be there. I think cycling has been for a long time, as much as it was an empowerment movement for women back when it became a viable form of transportation.
Yeah.
The industry around it, I think, has probably been surrounded by the same dynamics that surrounds a lot of business, that basically I think it's probably tougher to be in business and doing business as a woman than it is as a man. And you know, the more we address that, I think the fewer of those things will remain issues. But the fact that those issues are there does mean that yeah, we got some problems, we got some issues, and they aren't clear. They're probably not on the surface. You know, it's a lot of stuff that's ingrained, and it's probably also cross pollinated into other parts of our culture, I would say. Jeff, as a psychologist, do you have any commentary on this?
Top of your head, name a woman professional bike rider. Anyone?
Tweet, tweet.
Yeah.
Even if I was into racing, I don't think I would know. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it starts at, you know, just promotion and recognition and who is emphasized. And I got in a pointless argument with someone a while ago about why there weren't any women presidents, and his argument was that women just... they just didn't want to be president. Mm-hmm. And I said, pointed out the fact that, you know, up until 100 years ago, they weren't able to vote. So there's something in there too. But,
right.
It's larger than the cycling industry for right. sure. And I think that there's this assumption that if you see a few women mechanics on the part of some folks, that everything is fine and let's just move on with our business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been very impressed as far as I've seen, both here in town in Portland and other places I've visited, that it seems like there are a lot of women that are very empowered even today by yeah. the fact that a bicycle is something that kind of you can do this. And there's a lot of female mechanics that are working in shops and offering classes, you know, so that women can show up in a bike shop and have some instruction from other women. That doesn't, you know, there's none of that muddying gender stuff.
Right.
And also, I think what I mentioned, the flirty space is also, you know, it's fun some places, also not fun in others. So anyways, yeah, so that's that.
I'm going to actually give Steve a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. And I know here in Portland, there's been a lot more effort towards empowerment with gender roles, especially in the bicycling arena. And maybe that's not the case in Wyoming. I don't know. And so I'm going to give him a bit of the benefit of the doubt that maybe partially some of his comments are geographical in a way.
Yeah, and Wyoming's a different place than here for sure.
Right, right. Yeah, so that said, maybe you're not seeing a lot of women bicyclists in Wyoming. However, there is something to be said about the way the industry is set up and the way the industry is being promoted or has been promoted for as long as I can remember as a guys only thing. And that's kind of the way it's been for pretty much any sport or recreation. I mean, do you know any other women professional sports players?
Just a few.
Yeah, very few. I can't even think of any single person. I know that we've got a pretty decent soccer team, national soccer team. We've got the WNBA. That's about it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Tennis.
Yeah. Tennis, yeah, I was thinking golf. Tennis, but yeah, but still they don't get nearly the coverage that any of the other male counterparts get.
Yeah.
Well, and how much of that goes back to sort of pre-assigned gender roles that we perpetuate, right. And the fact that the man is hanging out drinking beer for 4 hours on a Sunday afternoon, you know, watching football while the kids are being taken to the zoo or something like that. So there's a, you know, I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah, you got your 1950s kind of stereotypical yeah. thing that still happens today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hey, we got another piece of mail, just a small one.
Rigel says on Facebook, "Hey, dummies," in the nicest way possible. Qualcomm sounds familiar because they were also the name of the San Francisco Giants Stadium for a while.
Because we were trying to figure out who Qualcomm was and why we should know.
Right. Because we're classy, we respond in kind. "Hey, dummy," in the nicest way possible. It's actually the San Diego Padres home. But then I'm no sports guy.
Right, right. Yeah, that was just my housemate Jeff actually pointed that out to me, and so thanks Jeff. Yeah, but yeah. Rigel, we love you. Yeah,
yeah. Thanks for writing that.
I also noted through the wonder of technology that Rigel actually is also Facebook friends with Rick Emerson, who used to have a show that I was a big fan of for many years. So, Yeah, a little shout out.
He gave you some bugles a long time
ago. That's right.
Ago.
He gave me some bugles, yeah. Basically, because I called in and said, hey, can I have some? And he said, sure. He was really talking them up. It was the chocolate, like the chocolate dusted ones.
Okay.
They're really not good for you.
They have chocolate bugles?
They have chocolate flavored bugles dusted with a chocolate cocoa powder thing. Yeah.
I walk right past Fred Meyer on the way home. I think I'll go look for some.
They're available at every Plaid Pantry, which is where I've found them for years. So, anyways, there you go. Give me just a tiny little bit of you.
Okay, my name is Miki Blizzard. I live in Washington County, unincorporated. I've lived there since 1979, and lived in Oregon since 75, and have four grown children, three of whom live in the area, and have grandchildren. So I've got six grandchildren in the area. Son in L.A., living the fast life of a... I've got a rock band and a hip hop band and a day job, happily.
Nice.
Yeah.
There we go. So that was a very useful sound check. That's the sort of thing that most people are like the rain in Spain, you know, and that sort of thing. So. Yeah. All right. This is the Sprocket Podcast. I'm Brock Dittus. That's Aaron Flores.
Weird.
And we are in the room with Miki Blizzard. You are a staffer for Earl Blumenau, or have been for several years?
I was. I'm recently retired, but I joined Congressman's staff when he was a Portland City Commissioner in 1994, and then continued with him through Congress, took a couple of years off to do activism, and came back and have worked with him actually most of 14 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a fun ride.
Maybe before we hop into the topic that we invited you here to discuss, you want to tell us just a little bit what it's like to work for Earl?
It's amazing. He's a very great guy to work for. I always respected his integrity and his thinking and his humor before I worked for him, and that only increased so forth. He really has a public good in mind and works tirelessly at it.
Yeah. Well, he's very famous for being like the bicycling congressperson, and we respect and are very grateful for everything he's done to advance and make possible bicycling here in town. And I think we had at one point made the observation that he probably eats bow tie shaped pasta for his lunches. So
probably does. Yeah. One of his favorite lines is that due to staff dictum, he is not allowed to wear a bow tie that's larger than his head.
Oh, well, that's good. I suppose that's probably just common sense. So what we had you in to talk about, and I believe it was Ellie Blue who referred us to your way initially, she told us that you had a hand in stopping a major freeway project some years back.
I did.
So do you want to tell us that story?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. I live in Washington County, unincorporated, about 5 miles west of Washington Square. And in 1989, we got news that ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, was planning a beltway, a freeway, bypass freeway through our community, not exactly where. They kind of had a general idea, but it would go from Hillsboro to Tualatin and basically parallel Highway 217, but about 5 miles further out. And being part of that community, I was immediately aghast and said, well, that's a really stupid idea, and got involved and learned that not only was it just didn't make sense for that community, but it didn't make sense for the entire region. Most of it was going to be outside the urban growth boundary. I had vast environmental concerns about air quality and water quality. It goes right through the Tualatin River flood basin. Mm-hmm. And there was no public or very little public notification of that this was going on, yet ODOT was out ready to buy right-of-way for this. And it didn't make transportation sense. I think something like 6% of the trips between Hillsboro and Tualatin would use the freeway. So we kind of got together and said, what can we do about this? And connected with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, who was very interested in the land use violations of this proposed freeway, and organized a citizens group to combat this and to see if we could come up with a better idea. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much the idea that we didn't want this in our community. It's that we shouldn't have it in anybody's community. It was just, really, there must be a better way of solving this problem. So we got involved and created an organization called Sensible Transportation Options for People.
Okay.
And the name actually came from the first stop in the late 70s that stopped the Mount Hood Freeway.
Right.
And with permission, that group had been deorganized, decommissioned, and with permission from some of its former members, we took up the mantle. We said, well, that's a pretty good reputation to go on. So let's go ahead and use that name. And sure enough, we had hundreds of members, mostly from Portland, mm-hmm. Southeast Portland, who were saying, what, another freeway in the region? This is a really stupid idea.
Yeah.
So we raised these concerns, and because we were out there in the location of the freeway, we caught the attention of several other jurisdictions in the region who had some questions about this and didn't think that Washington County had the best idea going, but they really weren't at liberty to talk much about it because of the regional decision-making about transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But once a citizens group got involved, they said, well, you know, we support your project, kind of, but you've got some citizens out there asking some hard questions, like, how is this going to reduce congestion on 217 and 26 and I-5, and, you know, aren't we just kind of making the problem bigger, those kind of things. So the regional consensus building for this freeway started to fall apart. It was helped by a suit, land use suit, that 1,000 Friends of Oregon brought against Metro, who was all set to incorporate this in their regional transportation plan. And so what happened is ODOT backed up because of these concerns, and they said, okay, we'll study this corridor, and we'll see if this is really the best transportation solution to it. But we'll call the study the Western Bypass Study,
okay,
which pretty much precluded a conclusion. And we'll have a citizens committee, and your organization can be part of it. And on the technical committee, they had all the jurisdictions in Washington County, I think there are 13 of them, that were already lined up and being on record as supporting this,
mm-hmm.
as well as ODOT and Washington County. Interestingly enough, they didn't allow the city of Portland to participate in this. They said, oh, this is not your jurisdiction, as if this wouldn't affect downtown Portland.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so they chugged on with this process of looking at all the alternatives. And we said, well, you know, one of the things that puzzles us is that when you build a freeway, you always assume that growth is going to happen at the very end, edge of the urban area. So what would happen if we've got all this land inside the urban growth boundary in Washington County? Remember, this was 1989, 1990. We've got a new light rail line that's going to go out to Hillsborough. It's a lot of vacant land around there. And what would happen if we put that expected growth in population and in business along the light rail line, along existing bus lines? What would happen to the need for a freeway, a new freeway at the edge or beyond the edge? And they said, well, we don't have to look at land uses. We're a transportation department. Well, I said, I know, but that's why. And I actually had an ODOT engineer say to me, well, you wouldn't want a highway engineer designing your community, would you? And I said, that's exactly my point.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they felt they couldn't do this because it wasn't within their mission. And obviously, they didn't have anybody who ever thought about land uses before.
Right.
And that's where we said, we've got to do this on our own. And by we, I mean mostly 1,000 Friends of Oregon, who had the wherewithal to put together a national study, because this question kept coming up across the country. What happens if you change your land use pattern so you don't need always new freeways at the edge? Because we're certainly not the only region that's been faced with this problem.
Sure. And Oregon and Portland, the area here in particular, is kind of unique because Metro exists, which is a tri-county land use organization, basically.
Right.
And that's not something that a lot of other people have.
Exactly. Like, we have the only directly elected regional government.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't equipped to do it. They didn't have the capacity. And the only transportation modeling system had no feedback loop. It always assumed growth would happen at the edge.
And growth is always good. Like,
right.
The more
right.
houses we can build, the better. Or
right. Yeah. And that's almost a separate issue. But the question of where it's happening, no one had ever thought about, well, maybe we need to kind of tweak, ask the right questions about this. So 1,000 Friends of Oregon interested some national foundations in this, as well as EPA, and got some money together to take a look at this question and to develop a new transportation modeling system. And they called this effort LUTRAQ, LUTRAQ, which stands for Land Use, Transportation, and Air Quality.
Okay.
Because that was EPA's connection, and they wanted to see, well, what happens to the air quality concerns if we have a different way of modeling transportation. So the idea was taking the same projections for growth and putting them in vacant land. So they developed a technical system to do this, a transportation modeling system to model this. And as ODOT chugged on with their Western Bypass study, we finally convinced them to include the Thousand Friends Loot Track study as one of the alternatives, which they did kind of under duress, but they had no option to do it. And lo and behold, in technical terms, it performed much better than the bypass.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of details about that. But what actually came out of that process, and I think was in that study was started in 90, and about 95, they finally came to the conclusion that the Western bypass didn't perform as well. There was a lot of political aspects to going with this because the conclusions of the study had to pass muster with all the city councils that were on this study: King City, Tigard, Sherwood, Tualatin, Beaverton, Hillsborough. All these jurisdictions had to say, okay, we vote for this better alternative. It was one thing to have the technical data and the other thing to get approval voting on this. So that's where STOP came in, our organization.
Okay. And again, that was a sensible transportation option.
Options for people. Yep.
For people.
You
okay.
got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Thousand Friends was working on the technical and the legal aspects of it, but they didn't have the capacity to do any grassroots education or organization. And that's what we did well. And we put together a lot of visual images of what communities could look like or should be looking like. And we went to city councils. We spoke at Rotary clubs. We had house parties. We attended every fair we could possibly attend and said, this freeway is coming. And if it comes, this is what's going to happen to your community. But we've got another idea. And part of what LUTRAC suggested, not only putting the growth in the right place, but then designing the communities and the streets and even the buildings so that people could safely walk across the street to the school or to shopping, mm-hmm. and to put the uses together so that the school wasn't in one place and the library somewhere else and the shopping at the other end of town. But kind of putting all these things together, the mixed use, higher density, multifamily, well-designed communities that Portland is still working on, our region is still mm-hmm. working on. So what was really interesting, we go to a city council meeting, we talk about this, and we talk about the technical stuff about the study because we're so proud of having learned all these facts. And of course, you know, we were right. And we talk about this and talk about LUTRAC, and then someone from the back of the room would say, oh, excuse me, how many wheels does a LUTRAC have? And we go, oh, my gosh. So, I think we're missing something here.
It's kind of like a bobsled.
Yeah. So, yeah. This is not a personal mobility device. This is a plan for a better community. So we changed our tactics, and we threw out as much jargon as we could, and we talked about livable streets, sidewalks, porches, safe crossings, slower traffic, traffic calming, more bike and ped facilities, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we finally got the local jurisdictions to think, you know, this really is a better alternative than spending millions and millions and millions on a freeway that's not really going to help us.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
There are some interesting parallels between that process and the whole Columbia River Bridge project.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is sounding very familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose there are probably some links. Like, there are some similar principles that, you know, people who are interested in the current issue might be able to learn something from what was done, say, 20 years ago or so.
Yeah, of course the CRC has been a real problem, real mm-hmm. thorn in everyone's side. And it's no lack of good technical solutions to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I think, a matter of getting the political will behind better ideas.
Right. Are you willing to make a statement as far as like what you feel about this current project, or would you rather leave that?
Oh,
to
sure. I'm not in any official position about this. No, but I've been actively supporting the folks that are presenting an alternative. Joe Courtwright's done a really good job, a common sense alternative.
Common sense alternative. It's the one that's been a little bit backpedaled. And for anybody who is not in Oregon and isn't familiar, basically I-5 has a bridge that needs to be replaced. But a lot of the biggest plans and the ones that are most likely to succeed are rather unpopular with people who are thinking about livability issues, because it's going to take a lot of new land and new paving and all that. So in brief, that's kind of what is happening here. But yeah, the common sense alternative is it sounds good, and common sense is that's something we can all agree on, I think. But as far as that's concerned, I there's probably more to talk about the West Side Highway as well from back in the future. But while we're on the topic of the CRC, what does the common sense alternative entail?
It would entail a collection, as I understand it, of smaller projects that would not be so intrusive to communities, that would handle the traffic better, siphon off the through traffic from the local traffic, allow much better ped and bike access, not only across the river to Vancouver, but within communities as well, and certainly not cost as much money.
Okay, yeah. Aaron, anything from you?
No.
At this point? Okay, cool. I was just curious about Thousand Friends of Oregon. They're one of those organizations that I've always heard of, but I've never really, like, they're not a pervasive enough presence in my day-to-day experience for me to know exactly what it is that they do. So do you want to describe them a little bit?
Sure. They were founded by former Governor Tom McCall and a land use young land use attorney named Henry Richmond 40 years ago. They just celebrated their 30th birthday last Friday, as a matter of fact.
There we go.
And they were formed to be a watchdog group for Oregon's new, at that point, land use planning program.
Okay.
Knowing that the legality was in place and the process was in place, but that someone had better keep an eye on how it was being administered and be willing to bring suit against jurisdictions that didn't conform with the state program or and help bring things to the Land Use Board of Appeals to just kind of watch what was going on. So they started out as a legal organization. Mm-hmm. And actually their involvement with the Western Bypass Freeway starting in late 1989 was the first time they got involved in transportation solutions. They mostly, up to that point, they had focused primarily on rural lands, protection of farm land and forest land from encroachment by housing developments and industrial expansion from jurisdictions.
Okay.
But they got involved in transportation then, and they really solidified their national organization with the LUTRAC project,
mm-hmm.
because that particular project and the transportation modeling system, that whole approach has been used now throughout the country. This is the very first time anybody had come up with a viable land use alternative to a transportation problem. This is a really big deal.
Yeah.
Regions throughout the country have been working on that. In my work with Congressman Blumenauer, I've seen evidence of that and correspond with a lot of different regions. So LUTRAC is famous amongst policy wonks anyway.
I would imagine, yeah. And we're known to be somewhat wonky from time to time here. As far as the just the example that was set, it seems like this was, like you say, a kind of a historic thing. It was people kind of responding against a decision that seemed to be not in the best interest of the people that live there. And are there other projects across the U.S. that you can think of that this may have inspired?
Oh, sure. There's a lot in the Washington, D.C. area, the Beltway there. I think around Boston there have been some. Numerous communities have faced this issue. And actually, the other thing that LUTRAC did was the whole question of the Western Bypass Freeway, backing up a little bit to just state policy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time since the land use goals had been adopted that the state had wanted to build a new transportation project. Because I-205 was in the works long before this happened. So to get a little wonky for a minute, there are 19 statewide land use goals. First one is citizen participation, and it's number one for a reason, because it's supposed to be very important.
Right.
And one of the goals is protection of farm and forest land. The other one is keeping the urban areas within the urban growth boundaries of the jurisdiction and the rural areas out there. And you're not supposed to put urban uses in rural places.
Right.
This is another one. Another one is air quality. And another one is an efficient, functioning transportation system. So when this issue came up, and when 1,000 Friends said, wait a minute, this violates citizen participation, protection of farm and forest land, the urban-rural use functionality, and ODOT said, well, but the transportation goal is just as important, and we're going to do this first and then figure out the rest of it later. And we said, no. You figure
that's
out the first part.
Works.
No, that was our point. Land Use Board of Appeals agreed with us, but they said to ODOT and to DLCD, Department of Land Conservation and Development, which is responsible for administering the statewide land use program, you guys sit down and work this out, because, you know, this is obviously an area, it's really, really fuzzy here, and we're going to run into this problem again.
Mm-hmm.
So figure this out, come back, and we'll work on it. And not only did they figure out how to do that, and transportation kind of certain other goals had to be satisfied before you could get to the transportation one. But they said, and by the way, we think there's probably too much vehicle miles traveled. People are driving more and more. Congestion, this is a growing problem. So as a state, we should be adopting policies that reduce vehicle miles traveled per person. We should reduce parking in all of our jurisdictions. And this was called the Oregon Transportation Rule. It's in effect now, and it really has governed a lot of what the state does. So we've got much better state policies because of this whole loot track study brought this up.
Nice. So that's it's like a tree that was planted and continues to grow.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of these policies then affected in 1991 the federal transportation bill, which is called the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act, or ICE-T.
Nice.
And that was a big change.
With lemon.
With lemon, you bet. That was a big change in transportation policy and set new standards and really helped move the federal government in a much better direction. There have been changes since then. That's a whole other topic.
Mm-hmm.
But it really made a difference statewide and made a difference nationally mm-hmm. on transportation policy. So it turned out to be a really, really big deal.
Yeah. No, that's great. There's two things I was thinking of. Number one, the idea that Washington County and all the farmland out there, it is very, very rural. There are certain parts. I like to do a lot of bicycling out there. There are some good camping destinations.
Great
in
places.
A lot of directions from
mm-hmm.
there. So if you like to go out, like say to the end of the Max Line and head up to Stubbs Stewart State Park or camping somewhere in the woods, it's really nice to preserve the rural feel of Western Washington County. So because of that, it seems like the freeway, I guess in some ways it really would have changed the character of that. So just the fact that is in place and that it was stopped, it wasn't developed, and the land remained rural, that's a lovely thing.
It is, and it's not just a matter of aesthetics, mm-hmm. because being a bicyclist, and I live out Shoals Ferry Road, and there are a lot of bicyclists out there, which is even in bad weather, which is great. But it's also access to ubiquitous places, to farms. So there's a lot of agritourism that goes on out there, and because this farmland's been preserved, particularly with the increase in interest in locally produced foods and so forth, and then, of course, there's the wine industry.
Right.
Ponzi Vineyard, their original vineyard, would have been right smack in the path of this, for example. Oh. But even if it avoided any vineyards, still the impact of all that urbanization coming out there would have been a real detriment to that.
Right.
Because right now it's very easy to get outside the urban growth boundary and to recreate and also to spend your money. You know, so it's a really big economic impact. And Washington County is really lagging behind Yamhill County, for example, in understanding this. Yamhill County's done a great job of protecting a lot of their vineyards. Washington County's still thinking big industry, you know, a little bit more. And this bypass issue's come up again.
Okay. So this is kind of an ongoing concern then in some ways.
It probably will be. Yeah. Someone called it a vampire.
You know? Okay.
Somebody split a stake through its heart. Yeah.
Yes.
But we
yes.
keep working on it.
The second thing I was thinking of was this first initial organizing effort took place in the late 80s. And so it was essentially a different world at that point. Now we have many ways for people to connect. People are on the internet all the time. Twitter and Facebook are mm-hmm. huge campaigning things. I get notifications for people who are campaigning, like, for example, about the CRC stuff all the time. And it seems like the nature and methods of trying to connect with people and do that campaigning in the late 80s, it would have been completely different. So what do you notice? Like, was it more difficult at that point, you think?
Oh, it was.
For awareness?
I don't know if it's more difficult. It was more time consuming. I remember countless numbers of evenings, you know, putting stamps on brochures and newsletters and mailing those out and taking big batches of bulk mail to the post office and trying to sort through their third class pre-sort stuff, and you know, just took an inordinate amount of time to do that. So and money mm-hmm. to do that. And now, of course, none of that or very little of that is necessary. So that it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And having people show up at meetings, you know, we drive around the community, having to drive out there, you know, knocking on doors in the rural area takes a lot of time, and letting people know that there was a meeting going on and things like that.
For sure.
So, yeah, but don't have those problems anymore.
You're also, I believe you told me, I think as we were arranging for the interview, you don't have a smartphone and you're not necessarily excited about it, or...
Oh, no, I just have a regular cell phone. That's plenty for me.
Yeah, don't find it to be necessary?
No.
Yeah. Do you have any Do you think that has changed the way that we relate to each other? I mean, in some ways it has, but do you notice that as being a big thing?
Oh, it certainly has, increased convenience. You know, I text my kids all the time. It's so much easier than calling and things like that. So
Yeah.
I'm not exactly Luddite. Actually, my husband teaches at PCC on development of phone apps. So
there we go.
You know,
yeah. No, there's a lot of potential for that. A lot of good. I worry a lot about the disconnecting nature of how smartphones take us away from what's happening around us. But that really does depend on the person, I think. And we can't blame it squarely on the technology.
No, so. And I think we're always faced with technological challenges, no matter what the era. And the key is to use it appropriately, whatever that means to you and your safety and your communication with people. Yeah.
Well, maybe, let's see, we are bumping up against the end of maybe a half hour mark. So as far as bicycling is concerned, what do you enjoy? Where do you like to ride? What kinds of bicycling do you like to do?
Well, in summer months, I bike commuted along with bus commuted. In the winter months, I didn't do that so much because there's no real bike lane along Shoals Ferry Road, and riding there next to 55 mile an hour traffic in the dark and the rain is not my cup of tea, no. But my husband and I have done bit of bike touring in New Zealand, and also we biked cross country from here to Vermont in the summer of 2000.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, hope to do that again.
Yeah,
nothing like it.
Definitely. Was that the Transamerica, the adventure cycling route, or did you
pick
your own?
No, we took our own. We hit the Transamerica a little bit, but basically we just stuck to back roads and just had a fantastic time.
Very nice.
Yeah.
What kind of bikes did you take on that trip?
There were Treks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Trek 520.
Tourings, yeah. 520s, yeah. Yeah. Great cycles. And that was good. Self-supported. I think we paid for camping 3 nights on the entire trip. And
there
we holed up in motels when we got really, really soggy. But yeah. Got invited home a lot to people. Met amazing people who just took us in.
Yeah.
So that was great.
Yeah. I should put a plug in right now. I'm reading the book Janipar by Tom Allen. I don't know if you've heard of the project, but he produced a film of his 5-year kind of round the world journey, which he did mostly on his own. And after making the film, he also wrote a book about it. And so that's been stoking my fire for bicycle travel in the months when I can't quite do it.
Hey, you know, I say to anybody, get out there and do it. Yeah. It's easier than you think. And it's just so, so fantastic.
Yeah.
One of the things I did want to say about activism was one of the reasons I think we're successful, well, it was a matter of timing. It came in, the freeway issue came up at a very good time when people were starting to question more freeways, and the economy was good. You know, if it had happened 10 years earlier, jobs were fleeing from the state. We had a lot of job loss here, and people would have done anything to build jobs, including building a new freeway. So we ducked that bullet. But it just kind of came at a very fortunate time. But the other thing was that we felt it was very important not only to say no to a bad idea, but to say, no, this doesn't belong anywhere in the region. It's not just our community, but doesn't belong anywhere in the region. And beyond that, here's a better idea. Mm-hmm. Because we knew we just couldn't say no. And people say, but what about the traffic? Well, this is what we need to do instead. And by presenting a credible, constructive alternative, that's, I think, really what made the difference. And very early on, we learned that, you know, our objective was to get people who disagreed with us to agree with us. So it didn't do us any good to go to meetings and stamp and yell and cause a ruckus and to make personal remarks about people and to generally piss people off.
Right.
Because they were never, you know, who would want to agree with us then?
Sure.
So we had to keep at things, give a positive message, find out what people were concerned about and address that. And that's basically what, you know, what made us successful in the long run. And I think that's one of the reasons why people keep coming back to this particular issue, because we were successful in doing it and apparently have set a, you know, a model for a lot of advocacy that's followed.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great idea. Just the idea that if you are against something, you have to be for something else because you can't simply be against. Yeah.
Yeah. The idea is to move forward, you know.
Yeah, and the goal is not to stop something, but rather to encourage flourishing human life wherever it can be.
Right. And that was so exciting about working on this project because you could work on something better, something that would make people's lives better instead of someone from the highway department coming and say, you know, here, we're here to make your community better. which means the road gets wider, there's more traffic, there's more safety issues. No, we're talking about how you can walk to school, how your kids can safely play close to the street, you know, how you can get around without a car. Mm-hmm. Things will be much better. And lo and behold, look what's happened in Portland. You know, there have been so many people that have taken this up and taken it to the next step and done so many constructive things in the bicycle community, in the educational community, in the social services, in the social equity, environmental equity issue. You know, it's really been very heartening.
It has, definitely. Well, Mickey, thank you for joining us. Thank you for telling the story. And if people want to find you on the internet, are you there?
I am. I've got my... Do you want my email?
you don't have to share your email if you don't want to, but if people wanted to learn more, 1000 Friends has a website, I assume.
Yes, thank you. 1000 Friends, and their website is friends.org. And if you go to the reports and publications, you'll find a loot track there. And they've got all sorts of technical reports as well as some kind of more generalized reports on it that people can clue into.
Very good. Yeah. And is it open to be licensed again at some point?
Yes, it is. Actually, the organization became Citizens for Sensible Transportation after the freeway was defeated and was promoting light rail in the region.
There we go.
Kind of superseded by other efforts that were going on. So there is no organization now, but a lot of the members have ceded to other organizations to good effect.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you again. And we look forward to thank you so much for your service, first of all, and then look forward to seeing what happens in the future, even if that's just a happy retirement.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's one of the best times of my life, it was, and now I'm embarking on another one.
Very good. Thank you.
Most welcome.
Well, hey, this is probably pretty close to the end of the show. Anything else we need to kick in here? I'm trying to think of what else is interesting to people.
Yeah, I've got nothing.
Okay. So, in that case, the Sprocket Podcast is done. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We do welcome your feedback. Send us an email. Get in touch. Appreciate your continued listening. And Indiegogo things. I'm still working on fulfilling those. I'm a slow songwriter, but I think I came up with a concept that I can use for Russ and Laura, and there will be another song done soon. So
awesome.
Yeah. Well, hey, shall we do this?
Let's do it.
All right.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com, or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hertbird for our headline sounder. Find them at hertbirdmusic.com.
That's right. Hashtag PDX Alive.
Yeah.
That's
and, a thing. And thanks to our guests, Dr. Jeff, Michael Anderson.
Definitely. And Mickey Blizzard.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are recording now.